Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and this week's advert comes from Ben Walker, who produces this show on occasion. Hey there, all you Rahul Leicester Pert listeners. Why not check out the new series of Ben the Producer's other comedy podcast, Do the Right Thing? Because it's rubbish, that's why you shouldn't do it. It's a panel show in which two teams of comedians have to work out the right thing to do in weird, wonderful and extreme situations, like the right way to escape if you're buried alive, the right way to form an exorcism, or the right way to turn down a dinner invite from the Queen. I was once on it myself, and I had to find out the right way to get rid of an unwanted erection, which my answer was to have a wank, which got us a point, so there you go. Or you can tap it with something hard as well. I know all about penises. Just ask me anything you want, I know a lot. I'm very interested. The guests in the new series include Rahul Leicester Pert alumni Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, Dave Gorman, Izzy Sooty and Mike Wozniak, alongside other funny people like Doc Brown and Joe Lycett, who's coming up later in our series as well. So, and we must get Doc Brown on as well. So if you want to find out how Catherine Ryan would survive a night locked in a walk-in freezer, or if Joe Lycett has ever seen a vagina, check out Do the Right Thing at comedy.co.uk/DTRT. It's also on iTunes, but don't get it confused with the Spike Lee film with the same name. Though that is good too. Now we've advertised Spike Lee's films. He's not going to pay us. You've got to pay us, Spike Lee, for that advert. Now let us enjoy this week's Rahul Leicester Pert. I wonder who the guests will be this week. I genuinely don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man who has done nothing that his mother was not expecting. It's Richard Herring! Welcome to this week's Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. It's the new week. Some of the cool kids are calling it Rahul Leicester Pert. Thank you very much. It's great to be here. So I've got this hand that I draw around. This is one of the hands that I've been doing for people who've done on the Kickstarter. I've been drawing around my hand. I'm 48 years old at the point this will go out. This one went wrong. I did it upside down. And so this is a. I'm going to give this to a lucky person in the audience. I'm going to choose someone. I wonder who I'll pick on in the audience. Hello there. This guy has a ready-made puppy on his shirt. We were discussing it before we started filming. His name's Hugh. He's a nice guy. How are you doing, Hugh? You all right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you do for a living, Hugh?
I work for a music festival company.
You work for a music festival company. Which music festival is it? Or all of them?
Reading and Leeds.
Reading and Leeds. Those are pretty good. I bet it'd be nice to you. Could get me some work. I did the Reading Festival once in about 1992, 93, seriously, and Nirvana were on. Yeah, I didn't go and see him. I don't really like music. Do you like music? Yeah, probably helps. I'm going to give this because I was a bit unpleasant choked having to go. He's wearing a poppy. He's got a poppy on his shirt, so he doesn't have to buy a poppy. It's not really. What is it? What kind of flower is it? It's a red flower. It's just a red flower. It's just don't get over it. Let's stop obsessing about my T-shirt. I'm going to give you this. Could one day be worth hundreds of thousands of pounds. It's a big... If, you know, I commit an atrocity of some kind, which is the way my brain's going, is quite likely. So this could be like as valuable as a Rolf Harris painting one day. Do you feel sorry for all those people who... Hugh, do you feel sorry for them? This is everyone. Like the people in there, when Jimmy Savile died, they had that big auction of all his stuff, didn't they? And all the money went to charity and everyone, I've bought Jimmy Savile's shell suit, gold shell suit. It's a bit bad, isn't it now? But do you think in another 10 years' time they'll be worth like lots of, like Hitler's paintings are doing all right, aren't they? I don't know why I'm asking you. Anyway, I'm going to give you that because I feel slightly, that's yours. Look, I'll treasure that, Hugh. Will you treasure it? If I come round to your house in 10 years' time... Be put on the empty seat next. He is surrounded by empty seats. There's one. I think, and there's two behind him as well. It's like a cloud. It's like the stink cloud. It's like it's evaporated. There are some just dry skeletons on the... Sorry, Hugh. Thank you for coming to see the show. Thanks for coming to the show. Thanks for the money and everything. I am available for the... I'm available for the Reading and Leeds festivals this year because I'm not doing Edinburgh. Any chance? No, okay. Some reason he's not happy about that. So, look, we're going to... I'm going to remember to fucking do it for once in my life.
Richard?
Yeah, I've remembered. It's too no good. You're meant to remind me. This is from David Frew. Is that in there? He is. I knew he was in. There's David. This is from you, David Frew. This is what David Frew has paid me to say. David Frew, it's not a real name. Paid more than a pound for this. He must be a fucking idiot. Let's see if that's made him happy. It's made him happy. Has that made you happy or less happy or more happy than when you make a nuclear bomb? Less happy. Less happy, okay. Does it make you very happy to make a nuclear bomb? Did you get the idea for making nuclear bombs from H.G. Wells? That's what yeah, he did, yeah. So he had the idea, didn't he? And then you thought, I'll copy that. You didn't invent the nuclear bomb, did you? No, you didn't. David Frew, he's a nuclear physicist. So, you know, think about your life and what you've done, and then reassess, because he's done something great. So will you please welcome my guest tonight? She is probably best known. I think most of you will have come to see her because she was Gail in Pudsey the movie. I can't wait to mainly talk about that. Will you please welcome Jessica Hines, ladies and gentlemen? Jessica Hines. Welcome. Hello. Sit down here. Pull up a microphone. Talking to a microphone. You can sit
I'm
there.
So glad you brought up Pudsey.
There's some water there.
So glad you brought up Pudsey, Richard.
How was it working on Pudsey?
Well,
I just
feel like it was really an overlooked piece of cinema.
Yeah.
I don't feel that it got the right kind of attention.
No.
I'm just looking forward to a chance to talk about it.
Good. Well, we have all
really
the time
about,
in the world.
And, you know...
Is it about Pudsey the dog or Pudsey the one-eyed bear?
It was actually a kind of philosophical sort of metaphor,
yeah,
for the decay of country life,
okay,
actually. That was definitely so what came up in the interview when I went to meet the director. And it was also about that was a sort of broad theme.
What is Pudsey like in real life? Was Pudsey in it or had he died by that stage and been replaced by a lookalike like Lassie was?
Pudsey was sort of like almost he was more than a dog.
Yeah.
You know, he was like a sort of he was like a spiritual entity, you know. like a movie star, you know. Yeah. And the thing is people dismiss the film but they don't know what it was like. You know, just being with him was powerful. You know, it didn't translate, okay. but it happened.
It was in the room. It was an amazing experience, but you can't capture that on
cellular. Being near him, you know, being around him, watching him dance, and it was an unbelievable experience.
Good. I'm glad. Your real name's Tallulah. That's what I'm surprised about.
Well, Richard,
I'm really surprised about that.
What are you talking about?
I'm just so surprised about that.
Why are you surprised about that?
Because why? Dad's what? Tallulah? Why
the
would you
story...
not choose to be called Tallulah if your name's Tallulah?
I was christened Tallulah by my aunt, who registered me at the registry office. And then I was then just referred to as Jessica. It just was the way it was. But when I moved towns, when I was 15, I moved to London. And I then went to A-level college a year after doing my GCSEs. So I did my GCSEs in London for a year. And then I decided to try Tallulah out at my A-level college. And told everybody that my name, having been Jessica then up to that point, I decided just to tell everybody that my name was Tallulah. And it did work until I had a birthday party. And then these Brighton friends came up and were like, why is everybody calling you Tallulah? What's the fuck is going on? And I was like, well, that's what they think my name is. So there was a sort of strange moment when... Everyone thought I was mad, Richard. And, you know, I was just trying to reinvent myself.
The new friends were right. There was the old friends you'd lied to all that time.
Well, yeah, exactly. Which way round was it? But
my dad was christened Thomas Keith Herring.
Yeah,
and he chose to be called Keith. That's an odd choice, isn't it? That's
he chose.
Yeah, well, that he.
Did he choose though?
I think, well, maybe it
doesn't work like that. Normally, you know, you could hold that against them, but normally how it works is if it's a traditional thing in a family, you're called a first name and then you're not referred to as that first name. You're just referred to as your second name.
I think it was traditional because no one else was. So I think someone decided they're going to be calling Thomas
Keith. But in order for him to actually make that kind of intellectual, that actual sort of assertion, I'm not Thomas, Dad, I'm Keith. How many times do I have to tell you? You know, at what age would that have actually happened, realistically? The realistic thing is that his parents just decided...
To call him Keith.
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
Doesn't seem like a...
Granny and Grandpa just went for Keith.
He was born in the 1930s. It doesn't feel like a 1930s name, Keith, does it?
No, it doesn't. It sounds like a 70s name.
It does.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like a modern 70s name, like Wayne.
My middle name's Keith as well.
Is it?
Yeah. But I call myself... I mean, Richard's a stupid
Richard's
fucking
a name. Great name. Well, it's a great name.
It's a dying name. We may get back to that later. But let's talk about... Well, I've just been watching... I think I did see this when it came out, but George the Sandman, who's trying to take over the podcast.
Trying to take over your life?
Well, he's trying to take over this job, really. He's just trying to edge his way in.
Let's get him on stage in a minute, if he does better than you.
Every week he comes in. He's usually having a go at the guests, but he likes you. Yeah. So you're lucky.
Hello, George.
He's back. He's right back
there. Oh, hi, George.
Is that one back there? He is a massive fan of Lizzie and Sarah, which I watched today on the internet, and I think I did see it the first time. It is a very dark and very funny sitcom episode, but a comedy drama.
Yeah,
but
it must always been a comedy pilot.
Was it always going to be was it a pilot?
Yeah, it was a pilot for a series we were going to do. The idea was that it was a pilot for a series of different characters that me and Julia Davis were going to do, and we'd developed characters on Resonance. We basically had been improvising between ourselves and then decided rather nonchalantly to just go to just turn up in Resonance, which was an arts radio station. And they had an office in Denmark Street. We said, what would it be like if we just turned up and said, hey, we're comedians and we just like to improvise on your radio station. How do you feel about that? And just like, would it blow your minds? And that's exactly what happened. We knocked on the door and we walked in and there was two guys kind of in glasses and black jackets. And we said, hey, we're Julie and Jessica and we want to just come and improvise on your radio station. And they were like, yeah, great, fine, cool. So that sort of just happened and we started improvising live on radio. So we did it over a period of months and we were going through various different things. And a few characters came out of it. And two of the characters were these sort of middle-aged women, Lizzie and Sarah. So they were the first. When we eventually, I was kind of reluctant, but when we eventually then went and took it and pitched it as a TV series, Lizzie and Sarah, the two middle-aged women, were the first to characters that we developed then into an actual half-hour show, which would, had we been commissioned, been a part of a series, but in the end up...
Yeah, so it kind of pretty much was self-contained.
The idea would have been to create a series of vignettes of different characters, and they weren't always all as dark as that.
No.
But they were the first ones.
So they were great because they really captured the... I mean, it's interesting, you play both the older women and the younger love interest women that the husbands are interested in, which is kind of a funny twist on it. But they are very recognisable, those very polite,
Women, I sort of remember those women being around, and women who, you know, are sort of desperately trying to, having been completely destroyed by kind of marriage and horrible destructive sort of marriages and husbands, how they, having lost all self-esteem, kind of almost in a kind of madness, begin to sort of rationalise the abuse that they experience. And then we turned it into comedy. but it felt like the right thing to do. These sort of coaches who sort of say, you know, don't worry, you know, why would he want to go on holiday with me? You know, he doesn't want to look at my big fat face over the table. You know, it's sort of like these women who were very kind of sort of real in a part of my kind of spectrum.
So what happened, was it the BBC?
And the current Comedy Commission at the time didn't enjoy it, didn't think it was funny, and sort of didn't commission it. So.
What a prick. It's happened to me so many times that I can't really. Are you working with Julia?
Yeah, we sort of talk about it. I hope to. You know, I know she's just about to land Hunderby.
Right.
Like a kind of big comedy spaceship that's about to land. That's two specials that we can all look forward to.
Yeah.
And then I don't know. I'm going to catch her. I'm hoping I might bump into her maybe.
Well, you're both
in
quite
Finsbury
busy.
Park, maybe outside a kebab shop.
Yeah.
One Tuesday night soon, and I can say, Julia, when are we going to work together again? She goes, oh, let's meet up tomorrow, and then we'll maybe do something. Yeah.
But yeah, you were sort of in everything that has ever been.
Well, it's a little bit of an exaggeration.
Well, it's only slightly. I've had both Simon Pegg and Nick Frost and Edgar Wright on this show, so I've talked about Six Pairs of Pants before.
Oh, yeah.
Can you remember all who the Six Pairs of Pants were?
Neil Mullarkey, Simon Schatzberger, Katie Carmichael, Simon Pegg, me... Sally Phillips.
Got it.
And that's it, I think.
Well done. Yeah. Simon Pegg couldn't do that, so that's very good.
You're like, Brad Pitt. I
mean. It's very confusing.
Tom Cruise.
It's nice that he's worked with Simon Schatzberger and Tom Cruise. Who's the guy from...
It is good.
He's from the Yellow Pages ad. Was he the French Polishers Yellow Pages advert?
Yeah, he was.
Very possible. You could save my life. Good. No, I can't
Very
quote
good.
Anything that Simon
Very
Pegg
good.
Did from the 1990s. So that is... was he J.R. Hartley as well? I'm not sure. But, do you remember much about doing Six Pairs of Pants?
Oh, yeah. I've got a really good memory.
Have you?
Like, yeah, kind of unfortunate. And I do have a good memory, yeah.
Was it your first major... TV thing?
It was my first comedy thing. No, I kind of had a bit of a weird sort of, you know, flurry of work then in my teens because I had an agent, unusual, you know, and I had an agent quite young.
Yeah.
And then actually, only retrospectively now, I realised that I'd made a mistake refusing to strip down to my bikini for, who's the guy who runs Miramax? Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he'd sent over a tape, somebody to audition me. It's a part I'd already got, and then I was sort of, I'd had an interview with it, because I'd done a couple of films.
Yeah.
And he said, we want to kind of re-interview you, but you have to wear a bikini. And I sort of, because I was a sort of feisty sort of person who said, okay, like, the world should not work like that, okay? Because you're not going to judge me on my body. So I decided to just do a really sarcastic sort of interview to camera. And then Kel Surprise. That was the sort of end of that trajectory.
The world
and
does I was, work like that, it turns
yeah,
out.
Yeah, actually, guess what? And then... And then I didn't really think about it because I was quite sort of, I didn't really think about things too much. I just, I didn't really wonder why then 5 months later I was doing repertory theatre at the West Yorkshire Playhouse. But nonetheless, that's what I was doing 5 months later, playing Grandma Title in Fiddler on the Roof. But like then, so for a couple of years then, I was just sort of still waitressing and working and waitressing and working. And then I got into a friend I met at the National Youth Theatre, Katie Carmichael. We'd started to do comedy together. We were doing different characters and live sort of shows, stand-up and characters, you know. And she was really good at being proactive, and she knew that there was this audition going on for a sketch show, and I didn't know anything about it. She was like, we've got to go along, we're going to go along. And so that's when we went along. And I'd done some sort of films, and I'd done a training video, and I'd done plays, and I'd sort of done a few things. But yeah, then I just went along to the sketch show, and then we all picked up sketches that were on the table. And I remember Simon Pegg's one, which was about Spider-Man being in, it was a guy who thought he was Spider-Man being in rehab, and he'd written it for himself, but I did it as sort of gouged out kind of heroin addict, and I got laughs, and I remember him kind of looking at me sort of but just thinking, oh, well, that's a different way of doing it. But we all just sort of then started to work together then.
You'd sort of got into comedy yourself, but were you performing in clubs together with Katie?
At that point, I was performing in clubs then, So we, but I was still young because I hadn't gone to drama school, so I was still only about 21 or 22.
Right.
So I sort of just started to sort of perform, basically, whenever I could. And then the sketch show just changed that. And we just started to then, it was Kim Fuller who was sort of overseeing it, and he was trying to encourage us all to write, and I was just started to write monologues. So really writing comedy monologues and comedy characters was the beginning of actually writing something, and then it getting translated onto television.
That was
sort of the beginning of it.
Cool. And that led to Asylum, which again is quite, I watched some of that. Which was quite, it was quite an obscure...
I think that was a Paramount production that was kind of, that was halted because, Tim Vine didn't want to do it because he felt it was wrong to make jokes about people who were in asylums. Whereas I had no moral...
Weren't wearing a bikini, it was fine.
As long as she's, so she doesn't have to get her tits out, that's fine. So then we started doing Asylum with, and that's when I met Julian Barrett, because Julian Barrett was in that. And Edgar was directing it, and Simon then was in it, having come from Six Pairs of Pants. But he was, but I think that was, Edgar had been doing the shorts with David and Matt. They'd been doing, because basically what happened in the Paramount Comedy Channel, which is sort of where a little explosion of comedy had happened, it was a sort of really bizarre sequence of events. They had had a fire in the offices in Nickelodeon on Rathbone Place. And instead of then just replacing it with office space, they decided to use the insurance money and create a tiny little studio. And as a result of that, the comedians that were working were able to then use that studio in a really kind of spontaneous and low-budget way to make things, which is where they did Puppet, Who Lives in My House, which was David Williams and Matt Lucas. And that's when they started working with Edgar, who was then sort of just new, fresh out of kind of his Fistful of Fingers. And I knew David Williams from the National Youth Theatre because he'd been there at the same time, and Matt at the same time. So they'd brought me in, and I'd done a few things with them. So that's when I first met Edgar. And then Edgar then moved on and did Asylum, which was something that Paramount had developed. And they were looking, they had Tim Vine left. And then Simon, because I'd worked with him on Six Pairs of Pants, said, oh, Jess would be good, bring her in. So I then came in and started then, we were all basically writing Asylum as it was happening. So we were kind of writing our characters and all living in an ex care home in Cobham. it was unbelievably low budget. It was a derelict disabled child's home. It was so depressing, and I will never forget like seeing on a pinboard downstairs one of the only remaining remnants of the children's existence, and it was just this child's drawing of the Enola Gay. it was, and I'm not even joking, it was so haunted. But we were And we were all sleeping because there was no room. There was no budget for accommodation or anything. So we were all sleeping in all the rooms.
Yeah.
So we could finish filming at 11 and start again at 6. I mean, there was no regulation. There was no... We just, in order to get what we... In order to achieve what we achieved, particularly because Edgar had a specific idea of what he wanted to make,
yeah.
we basically had to sort of live in this home for however many weeks. Wow. And that's when I met Julian Barrett, and Simon was obviously in it.
Yeah.
I think I travelled into work a few times with him and his Mini that was completely on its last legs. I remember a few times him literally getting out and trying to beat it up. But and then out of Asylum, basically, we had then Simon, a producer who'd been on Asylum, had said, because me and Simon had both been writing on Asylum,
yeah.
do you two want to do anything together? And I said, yeah, I've got an idea. And so then that's sort of then how the next stage
was. It something
started.
were you wanting to work together, or were you put together because of that? Was it something, did you feel
we
like
were
you
put were... together because we'd worked together. We did in Asylum, yeah. we'd worked together really well, and we'd worked on Six Pairs of Pants together. And yeah. then the producer had thought that as performers, we worked together well, that we had a kind of good sort of performance energy and a similar kind of, you know, we had a rapport. So he said, sure. well, you two should write something. You should do something. You should create something and create your own thing.
And so with Space, did you sit down and write it together, or did you work
well,
on it separately?
I think we had a chat about it. I had an idea for something. I wanted to do something that was sort of going to be more like a sort of sitcom. I didn't want to do something that felt sketchy. You know, I wanted to do something that had legs.
Yeah.
And I had been at that point then living I'd been living in London and doing all kinds of things. By then I was sort of 24. So it's like, you know, kind of 6 years working in restaurants and doing all of that. And I was just wanted to make something about those experiences. I wanted to have a program on television that reflected, you know, my experiences and, you know, and sort of then thought and created a world which, and I was just desperate to work with Simon again.
Yeah.
So I wanted to sort of write him like the best possible part that he would definitely not be able to refuse.
Right.
And I wanted Julian to be in it as well, but he couldn't be. So right. it was Mark Heap, but Mark Heap was brilliant as well.
Well, it was amazing. It was an amazing cast of people we got together. I mean, and obviously Edgar directing it.
Yeah, I mean, he came on quite late. He was on quite late. He came in after the sort of we, you know, he kind of came in after we'd sold it to LWT. We'd gone to LWT, and it was Humphrey Barclay who was the executive, and he was sort of, he didn't really start, I don't understand it, I love it, we'll make it, it's great, I want to do it, it's great, it sounds great, brilliant. And so he just said yes, and so we then were getting ready to go and putting a team together. And we were like, well, Edgar's obviously the best director, so he's going to direct it. So then he came on board.
It's kind of interesting. I think a lot of the shows that really hit as comedies are kind of made by a team of people who are sort of left to get on with it, and maybe the executives don't quite get it, but give them say, go ahead and get on with it. Is that, do you think that's fair, or is it...
I couldn't really say, I mean, no. I don't know, it sounds like a really easy, nice, like, obvious, yeah, definitely it's true. I don't know if that's really true or not, I don't know if that's true. I mean, in our case it was true, but I don't know if that's always true. It depends, you know, because sometimes things are just shit and someone needs to kind of get involved, you know. But, you know, I really don't know. I don't know. But I do think that... if you have people who have strong creative vision, that allowing them a chance, an opportunity to do it, I mean, is the best way to get the best, you know, work out of them, definitely.
And when you're young, you're kind of working really hard and prepared to sleep in an asylum overnight.
To sleep in an ex
with Nola Gay's painted
home.
On the walls.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you will do that because you have an energy for what you're doing.
But you had a family quite young, didn't you?
I was pregnant when we were just at writing the last few months of writing.
Right.
So I remember writing Spaced when Gabriel was 2 weeks old.
Right.
He was on my shoulder. Simon came over to the flat and I was like, you know, we were writing together. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think it's interesting looking at your career, and it feels like you're, you know, you, it feels like you could easily have gone to America. Obviously, very early on, you could have gone to America and done stuff, and you've obviously done movies. But is your family grounding you in the UK, or is that something that you want to stay in the UK? Or
I wouldn't say grounding. I would say more sort of like, almost like a millstone, like kind of like, almost like a sort of heavy kind of weight, like anchor dragging me down under the water. That sort of feeling. No, that's more of a...
They are like
more
that.
Of an accurate description of it.
Okay. So my fans will want to know about this. You've been in, you've played two different characters in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Oh, what's that about?
Have I?
Is that right?
Oh, yes,
the
I
nurse,
have.
Yeah.
Because I played the granddaughter too. Yeah. That's true.
That's great. So they were related, Severin. Were they? Were there, there was a connection between the two characters?
They were, yeah, I guess so.
You kissed Doctor Who.
Yeah, well, I kissed him. In a dream, in a parallel universe.
Well, it still counts.
Yeah, it certainly does.
How was he? Because he married one
very
of the...
Gentle, very gentle, very sensitive.
The, married one of the women he kissed, didn't he? It was it
Tennant? It wasn't me.
No.
It was the daughter of another... Do you mean in real life?
Yeah, he married... Oh,
it was the daughter of Georgia. Georgia. Yeah.
Davison. Georgia.
Yeah. Who was...
I don't know that much about Doctor Who, but he did... that the doctor married the doctor's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And then... Yeah, that's right, isn't it? Imagine that. Those nerds are going crazy out there thinking about that. he's a good kisser.
He was a very respectful actor who I kissed professionally, Richard Herring.
Okay, so because I was getting off last week on...
getting off on what?
I was getting off on Rob and Sharon having to have sex with each other for their work.
Were
thinking
you?
It was quite a cool thing to do. It was quite cool being able to kiss other people, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose so. I mean, it's... I think at different times, maybe.
Do you get any choice if you don't like the person? You say, I don't think our characters
would
kiss. I think that kiss.
Actually, there's an actor who, like, when I did The Norman Conquest...
Right.
..out with Stephen Mangan, like, when we were trying to work out the scenes, he would say I was a bit tricky, definitely.
Right.
I was a little bit kind of... No, I just... I think it's a bit... I was a bit sort of awkward. It took me a while to kind of, you know, act it, you know. A little bit awkward.
Yeah, don't want to kiss him though, do you?
No, I think there's nothing wrong with that lovely curly-haired, hairy little fella. But
he's no David Tennant.
He's a whole other world of David Tennant. Listen, there's no comparison, Richard. There's no comparison.
Okay.
You know, I can be a bit awkward about things like that. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
But actually, once I'm kind of, you know, like, I get it, I work it out, I'm fine. I can do it.
Cool. I'll ask you an emergency question.
Oh, go on.
Would you rather...
Really? Does that mean it's going badly?
No, it means that, okay, that people will want to
That's
hear
this.
That's
what I immediately think.
It means that I'm bad.
You're going badly. Yeah. Okay, fine.
Would you rather have... And also people will get upset if I don't ask them occasionally.
Okay. Okay.
Would you rather have a tit that dispenses talcum powder...
Yep.
...or a finger that can travel through time?
A finger that can travel through time?
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah.
What would you do with your finger if it could travel through time?
I'd
backwards,
just go
forwards?
And poke people who deserve to be poked. Eternally, like people in history who've really done bad things.
Who's got your goat in history?
Well, I mean, I don't want to say anybody obvious. Like,
yeah,
I want to try and think of like really... Oh, I'm just trying to... No, don't, because I can get quite literal.
Okay,
and then
no,
it all gets quite boring and pedantic.
No, believe me, podcast is all about.
No.
It cannot get too pedantic. Well,
who
that's
would
not
I
entirely
poke?
True.
Okay. Who would I poke? I'm just trying to think of someone. No, please move on, because I will, honestly... And
no, I want to wait. We've got all the time in the world.
Because I genuinely want to answer the question correctly.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to think of someone specific, okay? Because the only problem is with this question.
Yeah.
You've asked me, who would I specifically poke?
Yeah.
Which therefore, I mean, obviously there's the despots, there's the kind of Idi Amin's, there's the people who've, you know...
Do you think a poke is enough for Idi Amin? Do you think that kind of the balance, the score sheet, well, at least he's been poked. A lot, though, not just once.
I am very, very annoyed.
If I could do more than this, I would, but this is all I can do.
Yeah, but you can go quite Stalin.
Yeah. Would you not worry that it was the poking? The poking might have made them mad and do all their crimes. that's how history, that's how time travel works. There might have been a regular guy, Idi Amin, thinking, oh, I'll do some nice...
Oh, I'm pumped all the time. Kill him. Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Gotta be careful with this powder, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Maybe you should have gone for the talcum powder tip.
No,
there's nothing,
I'd never go for that.
There's nothing
that can
go wrong.
I would never want
with
talcum
that.
Powder coming out of my own breast. Yeah. No thanks.
In an infinite amount.
No, absolutely no way, not, no way. No way. Not interested. No.
I think it'll be quite good. I mean, the talcum powder tip is overlooked by most people. They don't think, you know, there's a lot of power, there's a lot of responsibility with the time travelling finger that I don't think most people appreciate. So we're talking about the name Richard. I've got a feature called Desert Island Dicks, which 8 Richards would you take on a desert island?
Wow, can I even think of Richards?
That's part of the problem. I'm there already.
The only
my
thing
island.
Is I'll just find the only Richards that I can.
That's what. That's
think
what it
of.
Is. Is can you think of 8 Richards? It's harder than you think.
that's the game.
Yeah, it's difficult. People get to about 3.
Richard, my mind's complete. I'm terrible in these sorts of pressure situations.
Well, that's good. It's good to find.
Oh my god!
That.
Like 8 Richards. Because, all know, I can think of is Richard the Third.
That's all right. He can
Richard
be
the
there.
Third.
Well, that gives you a clue to 2 more, I would say.
Oh god! Oh,
Richard the Third would be quite fun to have on a desert island.
I think he'd be. I don't know. Do you know what? He'd be quite fun to have. On a desert island.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily want to be in his kind of court or around him when he was kind of the grumpy king, you know. But like on a desert island, it would be a level playing field there. So I'd be happy with that.
Okay.
So maybe all the King Richards on a desert island and then I would take over.
I mean, you've set yourself a challenge there because they are already natural leaders.
Yeah, but
they,
not on a desert island.
Wow. But they're used to leading. They're used to being kings. I think. I mean, you could turn them against each other.
Exactly. That's
and
the plan.
Divide and conquer.
Possibly. I could try that.
Okay.
And then be killed myself, probably.
That's probably. It's a Richard is a weird name because it's a dying name.
No. There'll be
no
the whole. It'll come back.
In the 1960s, you know, my brother's called David. I'm called Richard. Those were like proper 1960s names. But now, no one. I mean, people still call David, but no one's called Richard anymore.
Aren't they?
Anyone under 10 here called Richard? See, that's a sample of 300 people. Not a single under 10 Richard in here. So that proves it. I will go back to non-emergency questions because there's lots of things to talk about. Let's talk about confetti.
Oh, yeah.
Because we had Robert Webb on the other week. He wasn't that complimentary about the film Confetti and the working experience.
I can
of
kind of guess what that area might have been, which I won't go into. That's his area.
That is his area.
That's his lovely area. That's his beautiful area.
You weren't naked in Confetti.
I wasn't, no.
Which probably helped.
Certainly the
to
film,
enjoy the
I'm sure.
enjoyment of it.
Well, I mean, you know, I just can't, because I don't want to disrespect them or their feelings about it, you know. So I don't want to comment. Because it's like...
By not commenting, you've said everything you need to say. Well, let's move on to happier times. How about according to Bex? What about that?
Oh, wow, man. Oh, what an experience that was.
I think that was written by...
Larry, it was...
I think Dan Tetzel wrote on it, who some of the people in the audience will know. I think he was one of the writers.
It was an American guy who came over and he had worked on... I think he'd worked on Seinfeld. He was an American sitcom writer and he wanted to try and do something in England. And he decided that this was it, a kind of studio sitcom. And it was the first studio sitcom I'd ever done. And it was a strange experience.
I mean, it's quite interesting because there's more mainstream sitcom than Spaced, certainly.
Well, I wouldn't. Yeah, I mean, mainstream is that a euphemism for shit? I mean, I don't know. What are you saying? Mainstream doesn't always mean it was just ill-conceived.
Yeah,
it had no, you know, it was his idea, I think, for a sitcom that would appeal to people who lived in strange attic flats. You know, it was just a bit, you know, wasn't particularly, you know.
But it was quite important for you, though, I think, to go through that, was it? Do you think? And then to realise that you didn't want to do...
It was absolutely not important for me to go through that. And I wish I fucking hadn't, actually. But I did, and so, hey-ho, you know, what are you going to do?
But do you not think that those things... They help me realise. Well,
they help you realise when you shouldn't do something. Yeah great.
No one remembers according
Let's
to Bex
do some
anymore.
More of those. No, they don't. I mean, it doesn't. You know.
You sacked your agent after it. Is that true? Is that
well, I didn't really sack her. I just said, I did keep saying, I don't want to do it. And then I somehow ended up doing it, which was my own responsibility. It wasn't really her fault. I didn't sack her. I'd been with her for a while by that point. And, you know, then it felt like an ineffectual way of exercising power that I had obviously not exercised at the correct time. It was a petulant and probably quite a worthless and pointless thing to do. But yes, I moved agents, Richard. Yeah.
It's good to know it's possible. So
it certainly is.
it can happen. And it is interesting your decision. Well, you know that you change. You, having been very successful as Jessica Stevenson, you changed your working name, which is quite an unusual thing to happen.
Yeah.
Is there a reason you made that choice?
Lots of reasons. I mean, you know, I think I just decided that I was more of a Hines than I was a Stevenson, and that I was more comfortable being that, and that's what I wanted to be.
Yeah.
So I made a decision, you know, on my own again, without telling anyone. Really.
Did it confuse people?
Informed and well thought through decision that I really had spent a lot of time, you know, poring over all the ins and outs, and then in a sensible and
I like it. I think it's good.
You know, I kind of don't regret it. I mean, it's weird actually. One of the things I really used to get annoyed about was traveling overseas. I've got family in Canada, and I'd have a different name for my son. And I just remember a couple of times getting stopped at the airport and them saying, well, so where are your papers? Where's the letter that allows you to take this child through to Canada? And I said, well, I don't need papers because he's my son. On your passport, you're Jessica Stevenson and your son is Gabriel Hines. If you wish to bring your son into Canada, we need a letter of authorization from your husband. And I just remember not hating Canada, because I love Canada. I mean, you know, I like all that, all those rules. But, I just thought, God, it'd be just so much easier. And I know, I mean, in a way, it's probably easier just to be privately Hines on my passport.
Yeah.
No one would know. It's perfectly fine. So maybe there's more reasons why I would like to be Hines. But I just wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be that to be my name.
Yeah.
So I changed it.
But see, it seems to me that your family...
A little bit of a pattern there. Well, yes, trying out Tallulah.
Changing your
name. Hines.
But also choosing... I think, you know, I think it's a really cool thing, because it's about loving your family and wanting to be part of the family.
I mean, Not so much. I mean, you know...
Well, again, you say this, but I think there's this...
No, it is. Of course it is. Of course it is. But I don't want to kind of make out that if you don't change your name, you don't love your family.
Because
there's plenty of women who don't change their name. Who I think are pretty much entitled to say that they love their children
of course,
their family.
Yeah.
No, I think it's a personal decision. Yeah. And I know women who love their name so much. I've got a friend who loves her surname, and she doesn't want to change her surname. And her husband said, I'm really bothered about mine. And so they've just changed, and they don't want to go back double barrel, so it's her name.
Yeah.
Seems fair enough to me. You know, like, you should be able to choose, and some people go double barreled. I was very happy to be a Hind, so I just decided that's what I wanted to do.
The double barrel thing, though, leads to, you know, it's fine for now, but it leads to problems in future generations.
Does it?
If that keeps happening.
What would be your double barrel solution? Your child's double barrel solution, if you did.
But then
it doesn't matter.
It's fine if it's, you know, it would be Herring Wilkins or Wilkins Herring if we'd done that. It isn't. We chose Herring because it's clearly a superior name.
And it's better it's more
Imagine
important.
Imagine marrying me. If you married me, you'd have said, no, I'm sticking with Stevenson. Yeah, that's that. Jessica Herring.
No, I'm sure I would have changed my name to Herring if I'd married you.
But it's like, you know, five generations on, when everyone's, you know, Herring, Wilkins, Smith, Jones, you know, you've got to make a decision somewhere. So people have to make it. Just toss a coin, maybe.
Yeah, you could toss a coin.
Or just shout at each other till one of you backs down.
I think in the end, like most things, most good things, it comes from, it didn't in this case, I just made the decision.
Yeah.
But, you know, in these circumstances, it's just, you just talk about it, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's an odd suggestion, but it, you know, but it's always the end the end of the road. Yeah. You have to talk about it and decide which way you're going to go.
I think if we're going to do it, but I suggest this to Victoria Corrin, and I got into lots of trouble with her, whereas I think I'm being very right on. I think family trees and names should go through the mother, because we can only be sure that the mother is definitely the mother.
Yeah.
She thought I was saying all women are whores by that, which I wasn't.
Which you were saying that. Well, you were saying everyone, that as well.
I'm saying
but just
everyone,
not only. Yeah.
Everyone is a whore. So lots of people don't have the father they think they have, but everyone has the mother. Pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can there can be accidents.
No,
mistakes,
I agree.
So certainly in family tree terms, it's you know, if you go back four generations, it's meaningless because, you know, you're really telling me the royal family... I think we go back two generations and we're not doing too well with that.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So, but if you go back to Richard III, you know, all the dads, and no, so...
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense.
So, you know, I'd say we should... So go back to Stevenson... Would you go
but
back?
That wouldn't have been my mother's name anyway. My mother's maiden name was Beckerman.
Oh, that's true.
So, I could have been that.
We have to then work all the way back.
Exactly.
Whatever Eve's surname was.
Exactly.
I think it was Eve Harris.
But you know, it wasn't Eve. You know, there was Lilith before
Eve.
There was
Lilith before that.
Did you know that?
I bet you
did know that. Actually, well, you and would know that.
Did you?
You
know,
would know that, wouldn't you?
Did you know also it's all just made up and it's not true?
Richard, what?
We'd go back, we'd all be Ian Amoeba, that's what we'd be called.
There
wouldn't even be a sex, there's an asexual.
I'd be a little heliotrope, you'd be a little amoeba.
And then we'd just have a little thing on a comet, we have to go back to whatever that thing was called. They found life on that comet. You know that comet in space?
They found water,
it's like
they found water.
They found, you know that comet they sent that thing to? You'll know. Yeah. What's Phoebe? That's my daughter. So I should know it's called Phoebus or something it's called it. All right, fuck off. If you're going to shout, you've got to get it right first time. That's the Wikipedia Borg mind. It was on like page 12 of The Guardian or something. There's life, you know, there's an odd chemical reaction in there. They didn't put anything on the comet that could search for life on the probe. Because that would be fucking stupid waste of time. It's a comet in the middle of space. But apparently there's something on there that could be classified as life. So that's maybe where we came from. That's what I'm saying.
I'm hearing you, and I'm interested.
God, but like some little, he sprinkled
God,
some...
God, so God...
Yeah, God started it, obviously.
Somewhere. He's out there.
Yeah, God started it.
Yeah,
but just
he
not Adam and Eve, come on. That's insane. It was Adam and a strange thing on a comet, not Adam and Eve. Bacteria.
What?
Adam
bacteria.
And some bacteria, not Adam and Eve. So anyone who isn't marrying some bacteria, what you're doing is... It's wrong. How do we get onto this? That's good. It was good you changed your name. Did it confuse loads of people? Did they think you were a different person? And Most people
didn't care. The majority of people didn't care. Three people cared.
Yeah.
No one else cared.
Okay.
You know, my friend's dad. Yeah. Said, I don't know why you did that. Why did you do that? I don't know why you did that. And that was about 2 years after I'd done it. Why did you do that? I don't know why. What did you do that for? And that was really the only real comment that I got about the whole thing.
I mean, it is your friend's dad, so that is quite a...
Yeah, I respected his opinion, sure. I mean, that's why I brought it up. But that happened 2 years after it happened. By then it was too late. And I said, I know, it's too late now. And he went, oh, dear, why did you do that? Why?
I just think keep changing every now and again. Just keep changing.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, just to keep everyone on their toes. You're doing quite well, so, you know, I think it just... I don't want to do that.
I think one's enough. Okay. I mean, the other worrying thing is when you do it, it's the kiss of death.
Yeah.
Once you've done it, that means that's it. You're imminently going to get a divorce as soon as you change your name. But luckily, so far, that hasn't happened.
Right, I've got a request. A man has paid to ask you this question. £60.
Has he?
Yep. Al, I'll give you the 60 quid.
Okay.
He's called Al Coulthard. Are you in, Al Coulthard?
No. He's not here.
He says, I recently spent 60 quid on this, which in hindsight appears to have been a bit over the odds.
In hindsight. Very good, Al. Already, you're on to a winner.
Just to get Richard Herring to ask a question and essentially do his job for him. So I didn't expect an essay of criticism here. I was just trying to... Don't complain, don't do it and then complain about doing it. You could not have done it. So when is the last time you mildly regretted pissing away a relatively large sum of money, and what did you waste it on?
Oh, a teepee. It's very easy.
Is it?
A teepee.
A teepee?
Yeah.
When did you buy a teepee?
Around about the same time as I changed my name, actually, Richard.
Yeah, and what was the plan for the teepee?
I was going to give it to my mother for her birthday.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you decided she
said,
wouldn't.
Why did you buy me a teepee? And I honestly couldn't answer that question.
Where did you buy the teepee? Did you buy it at a festival?
I bought it from a place called McCuntleth.
Oh, I know McCuntleth.
In Wales.
Yeah. Is it the teepee capital? Were you staying
it's
in a teepee and thought?
Capitals.
I have
we
to
spent
have one of these.
Like a hurricane for summer in the teepee.
Yeah.
And then my husband gave himself a hernia trying to take it down. It was a difficult time.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you thought, well, my mum needs one of these, an older lady.
It had been given to her at that point. Yeah, okay. We'd erected it for her.
Okay.
Yeah.
She didn't like it, so you wasted that. How much? He
I'm
does want to
tell
know
you how much.
He has. You don't have to say what you think a relatively large sum of money is. Aside, I really want to know what you think a relatively large sum of money is. What with you being on the telly and that as well. I mean, Al Coutard is slightly taking the piss. I think I should get some more money off him.
The key word here is relative. The key word is relative. Relative to what? I mean, he spent
£60 on this.
Which
so
means
was it more,
he's obviously loaded. He's
not
got a small amount of money to piss up against the wall.
He has less now.
He's got £60 to spend on that question.
What did you do with the teepee after your mother had rejected it?
Well, it was then donated, I think, to some local sort of like got centre
for Native Americans. Native Americans. And they said, do you really think we want a knock-off Welsh teepee? How dare you insult our culture?
How dare you? Did I just do that? Yeah,
I did. You did.
Yeah, I fucking did.
That'll be the next BBC thing.
Uh-oh.
The Native American character. what happened to Ants in the Marmalade? Has that come out?
Are you joking? You just got that off Wikipedia.
I did.
If you could, maybe later, could you show me how to take that off?
I've seen it in a newspaper article. If it's in Wikipedia, I then check it and see if
so
it's somewhere
annoying.
Else. Is it not a real thing at
it
all?
It was a real thing that I did with my friend who's an illustrator, and we wrote the story, but it never got published. And it just seems like, you know, we wrote it all and made it all happen, like on the paper, but then nobody wanted to publish it. So it's sort of, you know, it's there as a reminder of an un. Should I self-publish?
Yeah, you could self-publish.
How do I do that? What
really
do I do?
Really easily.
Okay, maybe I should look into it again. It's a beautiful, like, he did beautiful illustrations.
Yeah.
And it was just about little kid spending the weekend with his dad. So it's kind of all set in the 70s. Because I wanted to kind of, I like the idea of a children's book that has a sort of gritty edge to it.
Yeah.
So, you know. So it was sort of set in the 70s and it was about a kid going to stay with his dad at the weekend. And the dad sort of being quite a bit sort of maverick and swigging beer, and then him making marmalade. But then in the morning, all the ants get in the marmalade.
Yeah.
But then he eats the marmalade anyway, and it's all about how, you know, even when your parents get divorced, that, you know, sometimes it's okay. That was kind of what it was about, you know. No, yeah, that's
I'm
it.
Gonna write.
Everyone seemed to be worried then at that point. That was actually just a joke. It was just a joke. It was just about how ants get in the marmalade, you know, and you eat it anyway, and it's okay. You know.
I'm going to write one from the ants' perspective.
Are you a vegetarian?
No. Just I really care about ants. I had loads of ants. I mean, I used to kill ants when I was a kid. If there was a book about
okay,
that,
Richard.
I was awful.
It's okay. Listen, let the guilt go.
I used to put...
We all did.
I put newspaper down in the greenhouse until they all swarmed onto it.
Yeah.
And then I set that on fire.
Yeah. How did it feel?
It was good.
Yeah.
I felt like a god. And the head displeased me. That'll be good. Yes. You've rapped for Snoop Dogg. I've seen you rapping.
I rapped for him. In his vicinity.
He made you do a rap. He wanted you to do it.
He did. He didn't make me do a rap. He allowed me. He invited me after I sort of said, "Do you think it's okay?" And
he's, but you're an amazing singer.
Snoop a snippet.
You are an amazing singer.
That was really painful watching that on television because they kind of were joining in a bit more. And actually, having watched it back, it looked like me in a sort of echo chamber with a sort of far away bumble of slightly embarrassed audience members clapping really slowly and not that in time, and me kind of labouring this sort of really sort of stilted 80s rap that I was scraping from the back of my brain. It was quite painful.
I enjoyed it. But I've seen you at karaoke circus singing like properly, proper singing.
Have you? Which one? Not a good one, not a bad one.
Amazing. You're an incredibly good singer.
Oh, thanks.
Have you done musicals?
Well, I did musical. Oh, I did musical when I was at the youth theatre. That's the first thing I did as a sort of musical theatre. But I like singing. I mean, I've done. I did a thing recently. A friend of mine was an artist in residence at the Handel Museum, which also has a Jimi Hendrix apartment that they're turning into a Jimi Hendrix flat. And she was trying to do a Jimi Hendrix sort of music thing, and so she said, "Would we like to?" I'd met her through a friend or something. She plays the harp, but she does sort of jazz and improvisation. So we just did a sort of reimagining of Jimi Hendrix tracks, but with a completely different sort of spin on it. So I do things like that, but
sure,
yeah, sure, sure I do.
Good,
yeah, sure I do that. Sure I do that. Sure I play. Sure I sing Jimi Hendrix to a harp. Sure I do improvising it. Mixing it up, you know, that's kind of the stuff I do just
you're
all the time.
I like singing,
yeah. But I don't do it like all the time.
Well, I've noticed that you've barely sung anything in this interview so far. I'm very disappointed. So let's talk about 2012 and W1A.
Yes.
Did you play the same character in those?
Yes, I do.
And you got this character. I saw you saying you observed someone in a shop.
No, I was channeling a producer, really.
Really?
But I shouldn't say that because then now I know that there are producers who feel even remotely like her. They look at me like, is that me?
Yeah, but
there's
people
quite a lot of them who are like her, so it can be getting a bit awkward. It's a sense, isn't it, of a person that you kind of have an idea of. And with her, it was just this sort of the sense of being implacably confident and not letting anything kind of faze you, or you know. And so I thought if it was a distillation of this one person,
yeah,
and then a sort of just a little sort of, you know, just sort of tweaking it a bit, but that was, you know.
So there are people who are really like that character.
I've met a few people like that. Yeah, yeah.
At the BBC, just sort of
everywhere, really.
Yeah.
I think I'm less like it now, but I think when I was younger, you know, I had a kind of sort of I would feel often quite kind of just not very. I wouldn't know how to cope if someone was just calm and confident and talked to me. very directly.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know. I would think I had to, you know, so I would end up sort of spinning myself into kind of sort of whirlwind of nerves. And it was just, I remember a lot of people kind of, well, no, not a lot of people. When I was younger, just feeling quite on the spot. I'm actually putting myself in that space right now of feeling intimidated by people who are just extremely confident and just very kind of implacable and just don't give anything away. And, you know, won't give anything or kind of or take a joke on themselves. And you know what I mean? You can't kind of...
Yeah.
I think it's during a time when I was particularly probably quite a people pleaser. So I was always trying to get a laugh or a gag or a response. And then if I met someone who was confident enough to not feel they had to give me a gag or a response, it would just turn me into a kind of quivering wreck because I was just needing constant sort of affirmation that I was funny or likeable, and so those kinds of people would spin me out. And but as a consequence, I sort of gathered them as a as a character reference, basically. Yeah. And so that's who this person
and that's,
is.
So it's revenge on those people.
It's not really revenge because I've forgiven them, Richard. Obviously, in understanding my own part in the exchange, I have forgiven them and understood they were just being themselves as I was.
Do you think the BBC are crazy to allow a show that kind of mocks the BBC at this time, especially where the BBC is sort of being taken apart?
I think it's probably the best time to do it because this show is not going to make any difference. The BBC is going to be taken apart, you know. Yeah. Like this show is just, and you know,
it's documenting the destruction. In 1,000 years' time, they'll go, and this was the point where the BBC decided to give.
What it does is, in a lovely way, it embodies the genuine sense and commitment to real sort of satire, and you know, which is the thing that you lose when everything's kind of corporate and money driven. You know, people can't. You know, somebody an executive will say, "No, I'm sorry, but you can't mark us like this. You know, you can't kind of, you know, you can't make us look stupid because there's a bottom line and it's money. And in a situation which the BBC is, you know, the bottom line isn't money, it's entertainment, or at least it's a commitment to providing kind of programming for the British people.
Yeah.
But they're not answerable to a sponsor, which is why they're hated, you know, which is why Murdoch hates them. So, you know, like that, something like this is a way of saying, look, this is why we're here, because we laugh at ourselves. We encourage everyone to laugh at themselves, and we can do it too. And so I think it's a great thing for the BBC to do.
I don't think
being part of it.
Well, thanks for helping to destroy the BBC. So by using its goodness
against
it.
We're not destroying it, you know.
No, it's...
I hope it, you know, I mean, there's no point in saying any pointless kind of empty platitudes about it, but, you know, it is what it is, you know.
Well, it's sort of, I mean, it just seems so crazy. I mean, we're talking to Rob Delaney about the NHS and...
Were you?
Yeah. And he
what does he have to say about it?
He's saying it's amazing.
Did he talk about hiking?
He did. He was just going on and on.
When I was hiking up...
but, you know, we got these incredible things. We got the NHS and we got the BBC. And, like, we're not going... People aren't going, we have to save these things. You know, it's sort of just... By allowing people to chip away at them just gradually and allowing them, therefore, to become inefficient.
Mm.
And then they go, oh, look, it doesn't work, so we've got to get rid of it. It's kind of insane that we're... The British public are allowing
these things. I think that's what some men do with marriages as well, actually, I just say. I think just a little parallel there. But anyway.
And then they'll end up being shot by their wives.
Yeah, then they end up being killed.
That's why.
Anyway.
And are you giving free drama lessons to 20 state schools? Is that something?
I'm going to go and sort of talk. So I think drama lessons is a bit rich. And also I don't want to kind of interfere. Like, they've got curriculums and things to do, but I'm going to offer time, and I think what I'm probably going to do is do a sort of be a kind of just talk positively about, if you particularly want to get into kind of, you know, theatre or the arts, how you can do it, progress in terms of how I might have done it, but also answer questions and talk about you know, that it's important to kind of be positive, and mainly important to not feel that that's cut off from you just because you go to a state school. It's important to feel that it's an avenue that you can pursue. And I think if somebody directly tells you that, then it might have an effect, a positive effect. But I kind of thought a bit different ways of approaching it, and I thought probably the best way is to be quite direct and keep it quite kind of short and simple.
Yeah.
Because in some cases, I'm going to go to schools that are in different parts of the country, so I'll probably have to travel quite far.
Yeah.
So I don't really know, but I think that what I have to do is kind of condense my message and, you know, not kind of start leaping about doing miming, but you know, like, I mean, if that comes up, then you know, but it's mainly about just saying it's I mean, I hesitate to use the phrase motivational, but that's effectively what it is.
Yeah,
it's just about a way of just spreading a bit of positivity, a bit of hope, and saying, you know, it's not out of your reach. If you think it is, and you think about how can I do that, how can I even get to drama school, how can I even do that, there's lots of other ways of doing it. And it's, if you feel like it's something you want to do, don't give up on it, you know, do it. Mm-hmm. You can go and you can take part in a, I did a workshop at the Haymarket, and there were these two lads who came up afterwards, and one had sort of, not quite sure what they were from, probably burning the candle at both ends, but he had some sort of strange sort of sore. He was really nice. He was really nice and really enthusiastic. And he was there with his mate, and they, who was very quiet, and he was saying, "No, I love it. I love what you do, and I love everything that you do. And like, we were really into performing. We were really into all of that, everything." And I was saying, "Well, what do you do?" And he said, "Well, we're college up in, you know, Westminster." And I sort of said, "Well, you know, do you do any sort of performing or like sort of, you know, what sort of stuff do you do?" I said, "Because did you know that Mark Heap, who is Brian in Space," and he said, "I love Space, yeah." And I said, he did 10 years of busking. That's what he did. 10 years before he got into any kind of straight acting. He started on the fringes. And I said, "And there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't do that. There's no reason why you can't start at any point, you know." And literally, I remember thinking when I first was living out of home and thinking, how am I going to kind of, you know, how am I going to start? And thinking, oh, I had a busking act that I was sort of working on that was basically just crap magic tricks that didn't work that I would then bluster away in a comic. I mean, literally, that was the extent of it. But I was about to launch that, you know, on Covent Garden, and then I kind of got a job and got something else. But you know, it's just, I think people are, particularly young people who are by the very nature of youth, suggestible and positive. I think it's not a bad thing to just say, it's, you can do it if you want to. And it's can be sounding trite, but I think it's worth saying. And I think if it catches and people do things, it's a good thing, yeah. You know. And I think that there seemed to be a mood of just thinking, oh, there's just no point. It does feel quite...
It's definitely harder now, though.
Interesting you say that. But when you say that, what do you mean when you say?
Well,
it's
because
harder?
I think because like in the, you know, I started in the late '80s, early '90s, yeah. And you could come to London and find somewhere to stay for £60 a week, which was a huge amount of money. We didn't have any money, but was still achievable if you got a job, you know, part time job, and you could live very cheaply. I just, you know, now it's so hard to. Yeah, that's why it's all Eton boys, isn't it? I mean, not to say they're not good actors.
They're really funny, okay? Yeah. They're really, really funny Eton boys. I find them hilarious. I love what they do on stage. I love their stand-up. I love it. All of the jokes they do are incredible about Eton boys. They do a lot of funny Eton boy jokes, which are hilarious.
But they can afford to do it because they can. Their mum and dad can, you know, they give them a trust fund and they've got some money. So they can. You've got to put a lot of time in, I think, to be anything creative, you know, an actor, a comedian, you've got to put those years in. So, I mean, me and Stu, we came to London in 1989, and we were on TV by 1995, which was quite an incredible, fast rise. But A, there's so many people trying to do it, and B, it's so expensive to live in London or anywhere really now. I think that's why you get anyone who's got independent wealth can say, yeah, I'll be an actor and that's fine. And they can wait for the right thing to come along. But it's much harder, I think, than it was.
But I think that's why kind of getting into collectives and getting into groups and trying to take things, you know, to Edinburgh or wherever you can, it is the way to do it. You know, try and work out what other people are doing and go down, whatever it is, whether it's getting kind of sketch shows or you know, and just because where you'll find strength is in sort of solidarity, really. And if you are somebody who sort of wants to, you but it's worth doing. If you feel like you, and in the end, you know, that's what you will find your way through. But just don't give up on it.
No, well, and giving up is the worst thing you do. So what you're doing is a great idea. But also, you do have to be massively, insanely committed, and I think that's always been true.
Or just desperate, desperate for attention.
Or you can't.
Certainly,
do
my case, absolutely desperate for attention. Just 100% from the word go. And just that's it, you know.
It's worked out well. I want to know about the sci-fi stories you wrote at school. What were they were about?
Oh God, they were about planets, and they had foreign currency that was invented. What I used to do is I would imagine it all in my head, and I would start in the middle of the story without having really, really explained anything before or after. So I think what actually came out was a kind of, you know, absolute nonsense to a degree. Or you could say, like the beginning of an Ian M. Banks novel, where you really just have to wait and catch up. I just never got to write the rest. But, you know, that's sort of really where, well, that's what I would have this idea, and then I would start right in the middle of the story.
Yeah.
Which is, obviously, I've kind of learnt that that's probably not the best way to sell an idea.
Well, with sci-fi, you get away with anything. It is true. That's the beauty of it. But, is that not something you've written so much sci-fi?
I'm not writing sci-fi. I mean, I'm writing something that I'm sort of trying... I'm developing it with a production company. And it's not sci-fi, but it's set in a fictional world.
Right.
So it's set in a fictional world, and it's something that I've started off writing as a graphic novel that is now got picked up by a production company that I'm sort of developing as a show.
Okay.
And we just sort of developing that, and that's all set in a world that is non-existent, although it's recognizable. So you can kind of have a massive sort of cast of characters, and also that it's not a real world means that you potentially can invent things that don't necessarily exist.
Yeah.
Although you wouldn't necessarily do that to a great degree, because you're not talking about real sci-fi, you're just talking about license to, you know, create a situation or a scenario that is highly stylized and fictional, which is the purpose of having a fictional world. So, and it's fun creating fictional worlds and situations, because you can have kind of freedom to sort of go anywhere you want, really. So that's been quite fun exploring that, and having a kind of new central character that I kind of sometimes wish I'd just started writing her as a comic, because that was the idea at the beginning. But writing comics is really difficult, because you have to write the frames, and it's a whole different kind of discipline. And some, you know, artists are different and want different things and want different specifications. And so now we're kind of like on a trajectory of writing it as a TV thing, which is great. It's been great.
Yeah.
But whether or not we can get, I mean, I'm really hoping that it happens. It's sort of like, I mean, if it doesn't, it doesn't. But it feels like I'll be trying for my whole life to get it done.
Right. But you do an amazing sort of variety of stuff. I mean, you're creating a lot of different things.
I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah, and then in really different areas. I mean, someone like Lizzie and Sarah is very different than Up the Women, for example.
Yeah, Up the Women, totally different. Really deliberately, Up the Women was so totally different from everything. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wanted it to be exactly as it was.
Yeah.
And some people really didn't like it, and some people really got it and saw that it was deliberately supposed to be a fisherman's friend.
Yeah.
And some people with the tin and everything, but some people just didn't like that because they don't like fisherman's friends. Fair enough. It's an acquired taste.
But it's kind of that.
And then sometimes I just want to make, you know, lemon sherbet.
Yeah.
Sure. Who doesn't want to make it?
Is it a conscious decision to do different stuff, or is it just that you want to, whatever you have in your head, you think, I want to get this out?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Whatever I have in my head, I want to get out. I have a desperate need to get it out. And sometimes I'm successful in doing that, and sometimes I'm not. And
it's really hard writing, though. You know,
it's hard.
It's very difficult.
And especially when it's things you really, really, really want to, really, really, really want to do. If you're lucky, you get a chance to do a few of those things.
Yeah.
When you're just like, that's what I really want to do. And sometimes it's a good thing, and sometimes it's not such a good thing or whatever. But yeah, that's really what it comes down to. What's worse is when you get stuck in a situation where you kind of get bound into something that you kind of don't really want to do that much. And you're sort of, I've sort of had an idea, and they go, yeah, we'll just do that. And you're like, oh, but I don't know if that's really, really what I want to do.
Yeah.
Because really, in a spoilt way, all you really want to do is what you really, really want to do. And you know.
Well, I think it's, as you get older, when I was younger, it didn't, you know, I didn't care. I'd spend any amount of time on anything. And now I'm older, and I know I'm not that old, but I sort of think, you know, I might only have, you know, five more scripts in me. And so do I want one of them to be this?
Five is a lot.
It might be less than that. Do I want this to be one of them, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, like, a lot of the times I just give up something, you know, get commissioned to do something and think, no, that's not going to be any good, so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
not going to work. Whereas I think 15 years ago, I'd have just gone, yeah, let's write that. And so I find it increasingly hard to get on with anything because I...
Yeah,
we know. None of my stuff gets on though. That's
well, I mean, I think it's such a fluke when it does.
Yeah.
It's such a literally. It's just, it's a complete sort of fluke. It's timing and circumstance, and it goes into, you know, like the right person sees it and likes it, then that's timed with the right person also seeing it and liking it.
Yeah,
and it's a complete fluke whenever it happens. I think, you know,
but I think I think it's more than a fluke, but I think there's a lot of chance and luck in the progression of anyone. But I don't think anyone over a career can, especially as a writer, can chance it, because I just, you don't.
Yeah.
The great thing about comedy, I think, is that it does get a reaction. And so you know, when people go to you're not funny, you kind of go, well, you might not find me funny, but I know objectively I definitely am funny.
I fucking am funny.
Because people laugh when I say stuff. So it might not work for you, but I know it's work. If I'm doing live stuff. I mean,
when you do live stuff, if you're working up to a show, how do you actually get to a point where you know I've got an hour show? Like, when is the point where you know that that's what you...
Well, I have an idea for a show, and then I have this, which at the position I'm in now is a horrible, torturous time where you just go on with scraps of paper and half ideas, and you know the first few gigs are torture.
But do you find now that you've got a family that you find yourself kind of, how do you sense yourself? You obviously don't sense yourself more, but you don't. Yeah, it's a good thing. But like, but what do you think about because I don't know. I found that when I sort of went into sort of that zone or that era, there were parts of my life that were just so unfunny. Like, in a kind of way that's just like, I can't find a joke here.
Yeah.
You know, just hard, particularly when you're having a family. Yeah. You know, like, how do you... I mean, I suppose it's different for everyone, but, you know...
I think it makes it more difficult just because I want to be at home with my daughter, and then if I'm... I think it's just finding the time to do it. My wife's a writer as well, so we're both trying to work it out so that we can both get back to work.
Yeah.
And we haven't really done much work, either of us, for 3 or 4 months, or 4 or 5 months. You know, it's trying to work out how we get back into it. It's quite hard. But, you know, you've got to do it because you've got an impetus to work. It's a different impetus, isn't it?
Yeah.
I now can't say, oh, I'll do this crazy project where I'll lose 30, 40 grand and see how it goes. I've got to do a project that will make some money.
To kind of get a balance. I mean, I know there's people who do it really, really well.
Yeah.
Well, I don't ever feel like I'm one of them. I always feel like I'm slightly always trying to kind of get a good balance.
I guess everyone feels it, but you know, but you and Sharon and Rob from last week.
Show that I came to see.
Yeah, that's what you came along just to see what it would be like. And, you know, they seem to be doing an incredible amount, and they must... I mean, unless people just aren't seeing
really
their kids.
They look really attractive and fit and healthy, don't they? They don't look, like, at all like they have any cares.
They've got people
in the world.
They've got people looking
they
after their
look
kids.
Like
they
no
must take their kids the and put them in another family. And then whenever they need, like, a pressure, they go, yeah, the kid's in.
I know what you mean about... I'm just thinking about material as well, so I'm just thinking some of the stand-ups. I mean, I don't know about... But, you know, some of the stand-ups that, like, more recently, the newer stand-ups who were kind of talking about family, although everyone's done it, I suppose. But, you know, what you think about stand-ups like Louis C.K. and people like that who are just sort of, like, absolutely... They don't have any... There's no filter.
No.
You know, and they're just kind of, like, vicious about...
Yeah.
Oh, not vicious in terms of they're funny, but they're being kind of so honest, it's kind of... But you seem like that kind of comedian to me.
Well, I think you've got to be honest. I think it's got to be about honesty. And I think the good stuff comes from honesty. And I think you've got to think of a way to bridge that gap. You know, it's like when my daughter's old enough to read my disgusting book about how I turned 40 and met her mother, that's going to be a weird time. I'm thinking I can just hide the books.
Yeah.
By the time she's 25, I think she could maybe read
but
it and
I
go,
think by the
you
time
know,
she's 20,
Five, you'll have kind of probably told her everything by then.
But I think maybe
he'll be on your deathbed. She'll finally get round to reading your books.
I'll probably be dead long before then.
Do you think? No,
I've left it late, so you know the beauty is I get to enjoy while she's a child, and then I'll die before she becomes a teenager. And
you won't. You'll be there. You'll be there the whole way.
But I know that's a weird thing. But I also don't think that can affect you too much. But you've got to think about when you're writing about people close to you. You know, you've got to think about how they're going to react to it. But you can't always predict how they're going to react to it.
And, yeah.
I mean, I've written things. I mean, you obviously use truth, and I've written things that are based on my family, and then I've made stuff up, and then the stuff I've made up turns out to be true or comes true.
Really?
Yeah, and then they think you've written that, you know, that's like really, well, loads of times I write things that then happen. I think I'm like kind of got some magic thing.
Yeah,
I've got magic thing in me there.
But
yeah, that's kind of difficult. But but also I hope you, if you're writing with love for the people you're writing for, I think hopefully that comes through.
Yeah.
But I'm my new show is probably going to be largely about my daughter, just because that's all that's happening to me at the moment. So I think you've got to kind of use what's going on. And I do that probably more than most people.
I mean, do you think it's better to have kids later? Do you think that's better?
I think it was better for me. I mean, I regret it in a way that I've left it this late.
Yeah.
I'd like to have like hundreds of kids now I've got one.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
but I think for me, I think I needed to get through a load of stuff before I could be a good dad and be at this point where I'd be a good dad. I've always liked kids. Not like
I didn't have the same. No,
just because I'm in show business. I like him in the right way.
I know what you mean.
But yeah, it's interesting. I'll ask you another. Well, God, we should. It's lovely talking to you, and it's really interesting. I once auditioned for one of your things. Didn't get the part. It was the thing when you was about driving. Was it called? I can't remember what it's called. It was about driving instructors. There was New Zealand.
Oh, you should. Yeah. Oh, you'd have been great.
It was a New Zealand driving instructor.
Oh,
but
it was
I came in and said, I can't really do a New Zealand accent.
Oh, you should have got
and
it.
And they said, do one anyway.
Oh,
and I did it, and I didn't think it was. I can't do a New Zealand accent. I like friend. I can't do it.
Very good.
I can't even think what New Zealand people say now. I should have asked Sharon. But then they said, would you be prepared to cut your hair? You need to cut your hair. So I thought, oh, this must have gone better than I thought.
Ridiculous.
It had. I said no.
Quite right.
But I never got asked to do auditions though, so it was just nice to be.
I do.
Out the
I
house.
Do a lot of auditions, and I don't get.
Do you get? Do you audition?
Yeah, I audition a lot, and I genuinely speaking, don't get them. Although,
I nearly always get them because no one ever asks me to audition. Right. So when they ask me, then I've got a good chance of getting it. But I've been Percy the Shepherd. I was in Servants.
Wow!
Come on! Remember, he had sideburned servants. Come on, it was meant to be the great BBC
Everyone's
drama.
Getting very tired, Richard.
They are,
everyone's getting very tired.
Percy the Shepherd.
It's late.
Have you ever seen a ghost?
No.
I really thought you would have seen a ghost.
I've definitely sort of, you know, I've thought about dead people. Yeah. That's about as far as it goes, I'm afraid.
Could be. They could have
I could imagine that. I could think they go. They're not really ghosts. They're just dead people that I'm thinking about really hard. Yeah. And that's it, I'm afraid.
I smashed a mirror this week.
Jesus Christ, why?
Well, accidentally.
But why? I don't think because you thought there was a ghost in it.
Well, no, but it made me think about. What I like about mirrors is the idea, when you go to a stately home, I'm going to finish this.
When you go to a stately home,
I'm just waiting for the right moment to come out and just see what comes out of this. When you go to like a stately home and you see mirrors, I kind of think, wow, what's incredible about that kind of patchy old mirror is that Louis the 14th looked in that mirror and he was once in there and now I'm looking at it and I'm in there. So in a way, does the mirror capture everyone?
Is there a little bit of a particle of Louis left in there?
Yeah, there might be in there. So when my bedroom mirror smashed, did that destroy all the things it had witnessed in my bedroom over the...
Wow.
And is it a new start to my life after that? Probably should have broken about 10 years ago.
Listen, if you want it to be, that's what it is, Richard.
Because it's meant to be bad luck. But do you think it's bad luck just because mirrors used to be really expensive?
No, I don't really believe in that. No. I don't really believe in
that. I thought you'd be more superstitious.
No, I'm not really into any of that.
No. Are you coldly logical?
No.
Do you believe in God?
Do I believe in God?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. What do you mean, God? when you say God. What do you mean,
what
Richard?
Do you mean, God?
You are fast. What do you mean?
Well, it depends what you believe in. It can believe
well, it depends what you, mean.
I believe it's a comet. You believe it's throwing a comet? Out little bacteria at us.
You believe it's a comet throwing bacteria out. Like that.
It's got like a little hand in it.
Well, based on that, I would say there's several comets, because what there is in outer space are these huge Magellan clouds that are like billions of miles high, and what comes out of them are these solar systems.
Yeah.
They're basically like what look like tadpoles, because they're sort of, you can see almost the darkened centre and then the kind of concentric rings, but they're floating out into space. They are roughly the size of our own solar system. So you could... So if that's what you think God is, that's probably what God is.
Is there someone chucking? Is there someone? There's a hand though in the middle, right? Chuck in there.
Yeah,
there's got to be a hand. There's got to be a hand. Otherwise, how is it coming out? That's how. When there's a nuclear reaction, there's a hand in the middle, and they're chucking.
There's a hand.
It's got a chop in the hand. In that case, it's starting with a knife gun.
And they could even be like, I don't know. They could be sort of, I don't know, sprinkling something on it maybe as it comes out, like oregano or garlic or chili or something as it, like a sort of hatch, like a restaurant hatch of little solar systems going out, something like that.
That's a nice idea.
So God's like he's like a chef. He's like a big chef.
That makes us food, though.
It's interesting because what you're talking about, which is interesting, is God as a creation. So God as a force of creation, which is a different, which is a way of looking at God and creation, which is certainly one where do we all come from? What's the point of us from a scientific point of view?
Yeah.
Which is a good, I think, probably place to get to, to imagine that God is that.
Yeah.
But God isn't necessarily always what we come from or even what we're made of. I think some people think of God as a different kind of presence. I think that's probably what some people think of God
as. People think all sorts of different stuff.
They think of all kinds of crazy stuff, don't they,
Richard? Everyone thinks different stuff. Why doesn't everyone just agree? Why don't we just choose one and agree on it?
Yeah, do you know what? Yeah. I can't believe you've said that, because I was thinking that. And like, so, we should say something.
Okay.
Why don't we go to like the world's place, the world's like place where all the people in the world are, and just say, guys... Yeah. Just pick one and agree on it. Me and you could go. We'll go and go and say. Oh,
solved. That is that solved. Well, I think that was awful, that bit when he's got his pillow, that pillow over your face, and he's having sex with it. That's awful.
Mark Heap?
Yeah.
Should ask him about that.
Was that his idea?
I think we all know whose idea that was. And it wasn't mine or Mark's. It was that Jay Davis.
Well, we'll go backstage and talk about confetti. And I've been really loved. Thanks so much for coming on. I'm a massive admirer of all the stuff you're doing, because it's really exciting, really creative and exciting and different. So thank you for coming on to our show. I'm never nice to people. So that was
really?
Yeah, I'm usually horrible to people.
Thanks, Rich.
And the best thing you did was World According to Bex. That was the best one. Bring that back and everything will be fine. Ladies and gentlemen, Jessica Hines, Stevenson, Tallulah, Gosh. You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Jessica Hines. The music is, of course, by Pest. You know that. Even I know that. You must know that by now. Thank you to everyone at GoFastStrike.com and at the Leicester Square Theatre. It is very nice here. The producer is Ben Walker. This is a Sky Potato, Go Faster Stripe and Fuzz production for the internet. Thank you very much for watching and or listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with my guest Jessica Hines. I have to say this. This is from Nick Rosansky. That's a made-up name. Who wants me to say Brad Novak is a fucking idiot. I just feel that there's some people on the continent who are just settling scores between each other. I don't know where Nick Rosansky and Brad Novak are from, but they sound very exciting, don't they? They sound more exciting than my regular listeners slash viewers. If you've enjoyed these podcasts and want to help contribute, you can go to gofasterstripe.com/badges. Buy a badge, either one-off or monthly. You don't even have to take a badge. If you get a monthly badge, then you get all kinds of extras like backstage interviews from what we do back there, and access access to other stuff on the channel, and you get entry into a free draw and advance warning of exciting guests, so it's worth doing. Thank you to all the people who helped us put this together. You are very nice people. Here are your names: Matthew Smith, Ewan Duncan, Rob Applin, Darren Foote, Colin Anderson, Raymond Harpany, Kevin Tipcorn, Steve Mash, Dean Ratland, Gaynor Wilson, Adam Queck, Stuart Fawcett, Tim Turner, Julian Benton, Thomas Baldwin, Lauren Pilkington, Matthew Blackburn, Neil Martin, Jack Burton, Fraser Levy, Gina Lynn, Paul Jeffrey, Rob Ward, Robert Tang Richardson, Leo Vigoda, Carol Forster, Icky Kawa, Colm McGonagall, Aurora Watters, Jake, Heather Henderson, Simon Carl, Christine Sato, David Collier, Jijin John, Roy Owens, Matthew Poynton, and James Davies, Matthew Smith, Andrew Smith, Aubrey Hesselgren, that's not a real name, Darren Greaves, Daniel Boyland, Crispy Pete, Phil Warren, Gary Queen with a double R. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you to all of them and everyone else who helped us with this show. It was quite good.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.